What's up, my friend? Welcome to the Finding Direction podcast. My name is Stu Massengill, and I'm here every single week to bring you a passionate guest or message dedicated to helping you find your purpose so that you can live a life full of passion, fulfillment, and happiness. From the bottom of my heart, thank you for hanging out with me, and let's dive in. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Finding Direction podcast, and welcome to episode 391. This week, to celebrate our last 10 episodes we're going to be having on the show, I wanted to kick this thing off with an episode that was actually the first ever episode that we technically recorded for this show. It was not the first one ever released. It was actually the third one ever released, but today we want to throw it back to this episode, which really is where Finding Direction kicked off. And the guest that we're going to be bringing back is a man named Bernie Schroeder. To give you a little bit of his background, Bernie is an entrepreneur. He's a brand and marketing expert. He's an author of 3 books, and he is currently the director of the Lavin Entrepreneurship Center at San Diego State. And that is originally where I met Bernie. He was initially a professor of mine when I first went to college that had a massive, massive impact on my life. So we're going to dive into his life, his story. A few things you can expect is a conversation we talk about that he had with someone that was about to die that truly shaped his life. We talk about the power of curiosity. We talk about, you know, what he sees as he sits around and interacts with thousands of college students going throughout the process of finding their direction. And so there are so many nuggets in this episode. I'm so excited to bring this one back. If you have not yet, make sure you hit that subscribe button so you can join us for these last 10 episodes. And other than that, my friend, here we go.
So Bernie, we're here. I just want to take a moment and say thank you. You've mentored me over the last 7 years, definitely had like a major impact on my life. And so I really appreciate you coming out today and sitting down. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate your comments. I mean, one of the reasons I came back to the university was to work with kids who I would never really know otherwise. And so that's kind of my mission here.
Yeah. And I think you've done that. And
well, that's my goal.
Yeah. We'll see more of that as we get through our conversation. Okay. But I kind of wanted to jump right into this and go back to Bernie as a kid. I knew you were born in Austria, and yep. Then you later moved to Detroit.
Yeah, moved to upstate New York for a couple of years, and then my parents migrated to Detroit.
Okay. And so I'm just curious, like, what was your childhood like?
You know, if anybody out there is familiar with the movie Stand By Me, and for people that aren't, you should see it. It's about 4 young kids that grow up in nowhere and what they do every day. And that was my life. There was no structure. I went to school and then I was free. In the summers, I was free. There was no structure. I did what I wanted to do. So my friends and I, we did whatever we wanted to do. And I got as I look back at that childhood part, even though I was, you know, always doing some kind of a job starting at about the age of 10, I was being given a fair amount of independence without even understanding it.
Interesting. And were there any like experiences that you had as you grew up that you felt like, if you look back on your childhood and growing up, were definitive moments that basically turned you into like who you are today and all the things you've done?
I think everybody's got moments. I think you don't realize they're moments when they happen, and then you realize later they were moments. And so I'm not going to say that I had like a crazy exceptional life, but I remember, you know, one thing that stood out to me was when I went to school, I was super shy. I was like the shyest kid ever, right? Because I had a rough first grade. Huh. Like when I went to first grade, I couldn't speak a word of English. My parents had moved to a German neighborhood in Detroit, and all we spoke was German. So I go to a private school, first grade, and I can't speak a word of English. And The nuns just kicked the living shit out of me, either mentally and then physically a little bit. No damage. But my first 3 weeks in first grade were traumatic. I mean, I literally felt like I was a dumbass in those first 3 weeks. Kids were laughing at me. I was off in the corner. The nuns couldn't figure out what was going on. And eventually they figured out, oh, he's not refusing to talk. He doesn't know the language. And then it kind of turned. But I tell you, for the next 4 or 5 years, I just stayed in my shell. I didn't want to be seen by anybody. I didn't want to talk to anybody. And I went to a pretty good private school, and I just became unseen. What brought me out of my shell was sports. I got good at sports really quick. And I was two characters. I was the kid that went to school, and then I was the kid that excelled in sports. And it was like living two alter egos. The sports side of me was confident and cocky. The regular life side of me was shy and withdrawn.
Huh. And how would you say, because interesting you say that, because I grew up in a very similar way as far as being shy. I was more like kind of the shy kid, stayed in my shell. And one of my goals, actually, when I first came to San Diego State, my mom asked me, she said, what's the one thing you want to accomplish while you're here? And I said, I want to come out of my shell. And then I got introduced to a business where I was able to flourish in that. And similar to you and the confidence you had in sports, the confidence I had in this business, I was able to carry into my life and just make basically both these two worlds become the person that I am today. And I'm curious, how did you, like, if you had this confidence in sports, what made that and when did that like transfer to like who you are today?
I got really good in a couple of sports. I got really good in tennis, and I got really good amazingly in ice hockey for someone my size. Matter of fact, at the age of 16, I played up into the Junior Red Wings organization, which is the, at that time, the only level higher was the NHL. Right. Because college sports weren't really, college ice hockey wasn't really seen as anything at the time.
Right.
And so I was just really good, and people kissed my ass on the ice. Coaches kissed my ass. Everybody kissed my ass. I mean, not in a negative way. It was like, protect that guy. He scores 50 goals a year and he's awesome. And no, and it was awesome was all I would hear. Right. Yeah. Nowhere else in my life was anybody saying anything I was doing was awesome. Not that my life was bad. It just wasn't awesome. Right. So that confidence, did not leak into my regular life, because when in my regular life, nobody saw me like that. They only saw me like that when I was in uniform and on the ice and scoring goals. Right. And so still shy. Not on the ice, crazy player, talked a mile a minute, you know, talk smack with the players on the other team. Like I was somebody. It was fascinating. As soon as I came off the ice and got out into street clothes, I was just Bernie again, you know, and that did not change all the way through high school. It didn't change through a couple of years of college. It didn't change while I was trying to figure things out. And at the age of 25, I went back to school, and it started to change when I took my first marketing job. And the guy I worked for was just an amazing mentor to me. And he saw what I had, this tremendous talent, just a slight lack of confidence. Right. And he sent me to a public speaking course. I mean, he put me up in front of people. He created opportunities for me to speak. And then people started to say the same things to me that they would say on the ice. Wow, you're really good. Wow, you're awesome. And I was like, wow, this is completely different now. This is me in a regular world, and people think I'm good. Right. So I just started to take off from that.
And he was a professor of yours?
No, he was the president of the company that I started working for. He just took a liking to me and you know, no reason to hang out with an entry level employee. He was one of the last people to interview me for the job. It was a small 20-person company. And there was something about me that he liked or saw. And he just kind of went out of his way to start mentoring me.
Huh. And I know when you were in college, you originally dropped out.
Yeah, right? I went for a year and quit.
Okay. And so when you did that, did you meet him in between before going back to school?
No, I met nobody. I was rudderless. I had no mentors for about 6 years.
What'd you do during that time?
I did some amazing things that I wouldn't change. I started working. I couldn't go home because my parents were pissed, dropped out of school. So I took just a nutty landscaping job, like the worst thing you could probably take, right? Huh. I'm not on the job for 1 month, and the guy tells me that at the end of that year, he's getting rid of the business because he's passed his bar exam. He's putting himself through law school.
Right.
And I said, what are you doing with the business? He goes, just going away. And I said, I'll buy it. So I bought the business from him. Then I bought the next year, as I'm working in this exclusive neighborhood doing landscaping, I see a guy doing brick, same scenario, doesn't want to do it. So I buy his business. By the third year, I'm running $500,000 company doing landscaping in affluent neighborhoods, right? But I realized that was not an end to a means. And what changed it for me one day was we were doing this amazing landscaping job at an executive's house in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, which is like the Rancho San Fe of San Diego. Right. And he was a Ford executive. And we were on, it was a Saturday, and we were busting his concrete driveway out because we were going to lay brick.
Right.
He came out and offered us Cokes. So we were like, oh, that's cool, you know? And he sat with us for a few minutes. And I was like, how does someone like you own a 10,000 square foot, multi-million dollar home? And he was like, okay, I'll tell you how I got here. Hmm. And he explained how he got there, right? And now I'm starting to understand that it's not about where you were born and who you know. It's how hard you want to work to get something. Because over the course of the next couple of years and a couple other odd jobs, I got to meet people that were successful. And I always asked them, how did you get here? And some people were like, I go, what college did you go to? Didn't go to college. I'd be like, what? You know, where did you grow up? Oh, this happened, that happened. So all of a sudden I was like, wow, it's not the side of the tracks. It's what you want. Right. Yeah. And it all came to a crescendo. And in the last year before I went back to college at 25, I was an offshore race mechanic on 45 foot offshore race boats that billionaires owned. So for 11 months, I drove to party cities on the either bordering the United States or the Bahamas. And we would manage these $1 million boats for these billionaires. Well, guess what happened in that year? I got to sit down and have coffee, breakfast, yeah, lunch, dinner with about 7 billionaires. And I made it my point to meet with them, and they were gracious enough to meet with me. And, you know, I kept asking them the same thing. How did you build your company? How did you get here? And they were gracious enough to go, yeah, I started by selling shoes out of the trunk of my car. There was this one French billionaire that owned a $3 billion shoe company. And the more I learned from these guys, the more I was like, and I would ask them questions like, you know, what was your biggest challenge? What happened here? What happened there? And everything focused on kind of management and leadership. And so in that year, it solidified my mind that I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to get a management degree. I'm going to run a freaking big company, because I'm meeting people that didn't even go to college and are running $1 billion companies. So that tells me that I can do that.
Right.
Because they're nobody. I'm nobody. This is awesome.
So it's really meeting these people that gave you the light bulb that said, like, yep, I can do this.
Yep. And I still, even in that time period, did not have a mentor. But I made it my point to seek out successful people aggressively now.
And it all started with that one conversation over a Coke.
It started with one conversation over breaking up a driveway with a Ford executive. Me wondering, how does someone get into a top 10,000 square foot home and make that kind of money? I had no clue.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. So, I mean, what kind of advice would you have for someone, let's say, that is a couple of years before you started breaking up your concrete, that's maybe in a similar position to you, where they're maybe doing something, they don't know if it's like what they're supposed to do here, and yeah, they want to figure out what they want to do. Like,
so
what,
since
how
I came,
do you get towards that?
Yeah. Since I came back to the campus, I've probably talked to definitely more than 1,000 kids in state for sure. Yeah. And I tell them all the same thing, you know, no one knows. Don't let anyone fool you that they know, you know, because I'll run into these kids, go, man, I'm meeting other kids here at state and they really have their shit together. And I'm like, no, they don't. I go, because they come see me privately, right? So there's a bunch of posers, and there's some people that think they know, and then there's other people that are worried about knowing. I'm like, none of it matters. None of it matters. What matters is knowing that it doesn't matter and just maximizing your experience here. It's almost like I'm going to ask you to run a race, but I'm not going to tell you where the finish line is. And you're obsessing about the finish line. I'm like, the finish line doesn't matter. It's how you run the race, right? So you have this leap of faith and this trust that, okay, if this person's right, then I should just do whatever I want to try to break here. I should learn. I should meet people. And I shouldn't be so worried about how it ends. Because if I build a network, if I learn things, if I get life experiences and work experiences, some opportunities are going to come my way anyway. And then I just have to make decisions. That is the roughest part of the kids that come here and they don't know. I just tell them to calm down, yeah, and to enjoy why they're here, and to do things that get them to meet people. Hmm. Yeah. I just try to calm people down. I had no one to calm me down when I went to school for a year. I hated it. I hated my GE classes. GE classes suck. You know, they need to reverse the curriculum and offer major classes first. So then if you like them or don't like them, you're like, okay, I'm going to stay or I'm going to go. Right. My GE classes were so rough in business, accounting, finance, econ. I was like, this sucks. I'm out of here. If I would have had one person that would have said, hey, shut up, settle down. It's okay. Here's what you want to learn. Here's what you want to do. Didn't have it. I was a stranger on that campus. So I felt strange, felt awkward. I felt like a foreigner in a different land. And I was like, I'm out of here. This probably isn't for me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you would say it's almost not as much focusing on the subject of like, what do you want to do? But it's more about living your life, meeting people, networking.
Yeah. It's more about being curious. If you go to school, you should just be curious. I don't care what your major is. I don't care what you're doing. You should be curious about what you're studying. You should be curious about the campus. You should be curious about meeting people. You should be curious about going to an event. You should be curious about music and going to Coachella. You should just be curious. And that curiosity will take you to amazing places.
How do you think somebody like gets that curiosity? Because obviously, would you agree that not everyone has it?
I'll tell you how you get it. You got to quietly be confident in yourself and have a little bit of confidence in yourself to say, you know what? I'm going to live to be 100. I shouldn't worry so much about these 4 years or the next 2 years. I should just maximize what's going on and trial and error. Like, there's no perfect scenario. Do I need to go to business school to be successful? No. I talked both of my daughters out of going to business school. And yet they're very successful today.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Would you say throughout your life, because I know, like, let's say fast forward, eventually you were working in marketing.
Yep.
And then you decided that your business partners were in California.
Here's what I learned. And for the people that are listening to this podcast, you got to get good at something in order to have choices in life. So I don't care what it is. Be a surfer, be a photographer, be a cook.
Right.
Once you get to what is a status of expert, you get choices. You get people calling you, you get people wanting to work with you, and you get more choices. So after 7 years in marketing, six, 7 years, I started to understand just how good I'd gotten, how fast in marketing. I mean, at the time I was featured as one of the top 100 marketers in the United States. And I'm young. I'm like 30 years old now, 31, right? And I'm like, some of it's going to my head and some of it's not, because I'm running a $200 million account at Mercedes-Benz. So this isn't like Toyland. I got a team of 40 and we're spending money like we're printing it. And I'm moving cars, right? And so I was like, you know, it was almost like the old James Cagney line in one of his movies. You know, I'm at the top of the hill, Ma. I'm on top of the hill. And I was like, I felt like I was at the top of my game already. Even at 31, I was like, man, I am a baller in marketing right now. I could go do anything. And I am making the company I'm working for $25 million a year in profit. After they pay for everything on the team, all the expenses, $25 million is going to whoever owns this agency. And I thought to myself, why I'm running this account? Like, I could do this for anybody. I asked myself a couple questions. First question was, do you like marketing? I was like, freaking love marketing.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, how long you want to do marketing for? Forever. I was like, okay, if you want to do it forever and you love it, why would you do it for other people? And that was when I got to that question, I was like, doom, I'm done. I am done working for other people. And I started looking for guys in New York. We were all making crazy amounts of money. This is like in the mid 80s. And you'd see the movie Wolf on Wall Street.
Yeah.
I know it's a Wall Street movie, but that's what it was like in the United States. People were growing businesses and making money. I mean, I was making 400 grand. Other people around were making 400 to 800 grand. I mean, we are living La Vida Loca. We are having an amazing time. And I couldn't find him. I couldn't find people that were willing to sacrifice and give up. And so I met a guy on a plane. He happened to be a young Apple executive, randomly. We were seated next to each other in first class, completely randomly. I was flying to San Francisco for a Mercedes meeting and struck up a conversation with this guy. And we talked for 5 hours. He's like the director of marketing at Apple. He's in first class with tennis shoes, jeans, and a polo shirt. I'm in a Brooks Brothers suit. And I'm like, and this kid seems to be having more fun than I'm having.
Yeah.
So all I'm asking him about is Silicon Valley. I am not asking him about Apple. Ultimately, I followed up with him and took a 2-year consulting gig with Apple to work with their senior marketing people and make their marketing better at the time. Only to get to Silicon Valley, because he had described a valley to me that I had never heard of or seen before. You got to remember, Silicon Valley in the late 80s was nothing in terms of awareness or culture or a place you actually wanted to go unless you were a nerd. at that time period. But what he was telling me was all these people were taking risks and starting companies, and it was the wild, wild west. And I was like, shit, that's where I want to be, right? Because the guys I'm looking for, they're there. And I told my wife when we were moving, I said, hey, I'm taking a 2-year gig with Apple. She's like, why? I go, I want to get to the Valley. Why? Because I want to meet the guys I'm looking for. Why? To build a new type of a marketing agency. Why? Because that's, I want to create my own company. Okay. Where are they? Don't know. When will you meet them? Don't know. How much is Apple paying you? Oh, I'm taking a 60% cut in pay. She was like, why are we going?
Yeah.
And ultimately, within 6 months, I met the guys. I was introduced to them by an executive at Apple. I knew the instant I met them, three guys. Took me a year to get them to make me the fourth guy. And then it took, and in that time period, I changed their mind about what they wanted to do with their little design company. And we ended up in the next 5 years building a $1 billion company and taking it public. Crazy.
Very crazy. So going back to when you moved out to California, you had that bold decision and obviously that interesting conversation with your wife about your life across the country. Would you say that the like majority of your belief and confidence to go there was because you'd already been successful, you'd already achieved a bunch of things in life, so it was easy to make a decision to go? Like, you already had confidence in yourself, essentially?
I had confidence that I wanted to eat the world. I mean, I grew up in a large European family in Detroit, blue collar, where my brothers and sisters all, even today, live within 10 miles of my parents' house, and they think a magnificent trip is going to Florida. And as I was growing up, I wanted to eat the world. I wanted to travel. I wanted to ski mountains in faraway lands. I wanted to fall into oceans I hadn't heard of, right? And that's why I went to New York. I went to New York once I got good in Detroit to get out of Detroit. I didn't necessarily want to go to New York. I mean, the Mercedes deal was sweet, yeah, and it came up and I took it to escape. But once I got to New York and saw that I could really be good at marketing, then I was like, okay, I don't want to be in New York and play this wax on, wax off game for all these people for 20 years. I'm going to, now that I believe I'm good enough and I've got the confidence, I'm going to go start a company. I just need to go find the guys I'm going to do it with.
Right.
So I would say part of it is the little voice inside your head that you hear when you're 12, 13, 14, 16, 18, 19, that says you should do something. And I think at some point you got to trust yourself. I had people tell me my entire career, including my family, you know, you're arrogant, you're aloof, you're the bad wolf, you're the black sheep. You don't want to come to the family reunions. You don't want to be part of everything. And I tried explaining to them how much I wanted to be an adventure and journey and be challenged to the max in my life. They did not understand it. They were like, just get a job at Ford, shut the hell up, pound out 3 or 4 kids, live in suburbia, and someday, if you're lucky, you retire to Florida.
And so how did you cope with that?
I left.
But like, so for people that are out
there. It was easy. I left.
Right.
I worked really hard in Detroit to get out, Stu. Worked so hard. Like, no one could understand how many hours I was working. I was working 80, 90 hours a week to build my marketing career, right? And everybody was like, you're not getting paid for that kind of money. Why are you doing that? I told no one that I was escaping. I just said, hey, I just love what I do. I love what I do. I kept saying it. And I actually did love what I did. But my plan was get really good, really fast, and get out.
So, like, what advice would you have for people that are out there that, let's say, like, they do have some sort of a gut feeling that they're supposed to do something, or maybe their parents were raised a different way and have different beliefs, or even like society says they shouldn't do it. Like, when you dropped out of college, I'm sure that wasn't societal norms. And obviously people are yelling at you, you're an idiot, all this stuff. So like, for people that have an idea of what they want to do, but society or their parents or someone is telling them like, that's not how you're supposed to live your life. Like, what advice would you give them to like confidently follow what it is they feel on the inside that they should do?
You know, that's a tough one, 'cause I think it's really individual, but I think everyone's got a path in life. And I think you got to try to find that path rather than follow someone else's path. I mean, I once had a student who came to me and was really frustrated, I think she was in the accounting program here, hated it.
Yeah.
And she was like 21. And I just said, okay, I have, you know, good news and bad news. And she goes, well, what's the bad news? I go, your entire family just died in a plane crash. She just like sat back at the desk, was like, okay. I go, now the good news is you get to choose what you want to do. You're no longer living for anyone else. The reason she was in the accounting program was because her dad said, you should get an accounting degree. It's safe. You can make money. She hated it. And I was like, okay, now that your parents are dead and your siblings, what are you going to do? Who are you living for now? And it stunned her. She dropped out of the program. She changed major. She went into comm. She's a successful PR person right now. Most people, when they don't know exactly what they want to do, they listen too hard to what other people want them to be. And they kind of give up on what they think they should be. And to them, it's temporary at the time. And it might even be temporary because you're 21, 22, you know, you don't know shit about a professional career yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't me my whole life. I mean, I was that kid that asked why a lot. And not a good question to ask, by the way, in a European family. I remember asking why one time of my grandfather. By the way, just make it clear, I loved my grandparents and my parents. Yeah. It's just a strict family. Yeah. I remember asking why one day when I was on my at the lunch table with my grandfather. I was probably 10 or 11, and he had a gorgeous farm in Windsor, Canada. So we'd jump across the border, and I'd stay over there every summer because it was just cool for a kid to be on a farm. Yeah. And I asked why at the lunch table, and I don't even remember hitting the floor. Like, I looked up from the floor at my grandfather, who'd never touched me before in his life, and he didn't even break stride in eating, and he just said, you're not old enough to ever ask why. You just do what we tell you. And I thought, okay, duly noted. Duly noted. But it was like that kind of, when the way I took it, I didn't take it as like, wow, that's vicious or this or that. Yeah. I took it like, okay, I'm part of a wolf pack that I'm not quite understanding the hierarchy, but I just had a dominant wolf kind of tell me where I was in the hierarchy. So I'm going to pay attention to that.
So what like kept pushing you? Because it seems like everything in your life was basically everyone on the outside saying, you're doing it wrong. This isn't working. Like you know, like,
no, I don't think they were saying you're doing it wrong. They saw me working at the age of 10 and 11. They saw me saving my money. They saw me spending it. I mean, I went to school. I was almost valedictorian in the private school. I wasn't absent. I didn't talk back to teachers. I didn't talk back to my parents. Nobody was telling me I was doing anything wrong. I was just questioning what my life was going to be. And I think that's one of the things that made me drop out of school after 1 year. So I had no idea. So then when I hate school, when you have no idea what you're going to do in life and you hate school, it's hard to stay in school because you're like, I need to check out, right? I need to go find something else because this isn't making me happy. And the interesting thing is in European families, and I think it's true of a lot of European families, happiness is not a goal. Accomplishment is a goal. So I used to say to people, yeah, I'm just not happy about going to school. They'd be like, shut up and go. Or I don't like my job. Yeah. Shut up and go. Like, you're making money. What do you mean you don't like your job? You're not supposed to like your job. You're supposed to make money from the job. Right. And I was like, wow. Like, I'm supposed to, if I don't like what I'm doing it because I'm making a living and that's somehow supporting my life. Something's in my mind that did not connect. I was like, I made up my mind. And I'd say the one cathartic moment that I had in my life that cemented it for me was when I was 19. My dad told me that my aunt was dying, my favorite aunt. And I was like, that's impossible. She's like 37 years old. She's healthy as shit. And he's like, no, you know, that stomach cramp she's been having for like 6 or 8 months. I go, yeah. Well, she finally went to a doctor. They told her she has inoperable cancer and she has 3 weeks to live. You should go talk to her. And I was like, how do you talk to a person that knows they're going to die? So I wait like a week. I don't go. Then I get a phone call from her. She's like, you going to come see me? I mean, my favorite aunt.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, so I drive over, she's in Canada, drive across the border, go to her room in the hospice. She's sitting on the bed, looks healthy as ever. And there is a mound of paper on the bed covering almost every square inch. And I go, what are you doing? She's like, I'm getting my life in order so that people won't have to do anything when I die. And I was like, smack. And then she said, she saw me. She's new. Like, I was not handling this, right? She's like, come here. She's like, sit on the bed. And she's just like, she'd already accepted everything. She went through all seven phases and she was already in acceptance, you know? And I go, she's like, it's okay. It's okay. I go, how are you handling this? Like, yeah, I'm sitting here talking to you and you're going to be dead in 2 weeks. And she's like, it is what it is. I've arrived at it, but let me tell you about my regrets. And being my favorite aunt, all I ever saw from her was happiness and joy. And I did the funnest things with her. And now she never mentioned one word about a regret. Mm-hmm. And so she goes, let me tell you about my regrets. I regret that I didn't marry the person that, you know, grandma and grandpa said wasn't good enough for me. Love of my life. I regret not doing this. I regret. And for about an hour, she laid all these regrets on me that I had never heard. And I was just kind of like dumbfounded. And then, you know, spent another hour with her, hugged her, knowing I wouldn't see her. Right. And I left. And I remember going out to my car and just sitting in my car. And I literally was like, okay, I'll tell you what, if I'm ever sitting on a bed somewhere, ain't going to have one goddamn regret. And that is what caused all other things start to spiral. Like that was right when I was in school at Michigan and it was like, I am out. I'm not going to regret that. I'm going to regret going to a school I hate. Yeah. And I just started to measure everything that I was doing by, will you regret not doing that? Will you regret not going to that? Will you regret not going to Laguna with your friends and quitting your current job? I did whatever I wanted from then on out. Whatever I wanted to do, I did it.
Dang.
Yeah. Because she showed me death.
Yeah.
When you're 19, you are not going to die. I don't care what you're doing. You're not going to die. You have no concept of death. When you sit down with someone who is going to die and it is a finality, it just hits you that this person is going in the ground in 2 weeks. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Their life is over. And I was sitting there going, okay, I don't know how long I'm going to live, but I ain't sitting on a bed telling anybody about regrets. And I don't really tell that conversation to a lot of people. I never told it to my parents, probably told it to my wife, a couple other people, maybe my friends. But a lot of people started looking at how I was behaving, never told my brothers and sisters, but they were just like, what's wrong with you? And I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm not going there. I'm not, you know, being part of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So to go back a little bit, obviously marketing, and we'll get into this in a little bit, and you talked about it earlier, is something that you ran with CKS Partners and you guys turned this into a $1 billion company. But to go back to the seed, you said you have to get good at something.
Mm-hmm.
What made you decide that was marketing for you?
You know, I only had one marketing class when I got my management degree, and quite honestly, I hated it because the professor was an idiot. So when I came out, you know, I look like, I guess, your typical 27 and a half, 28 year old college graduate. I had stubble on my face, a hair in a ponytail. I dressed exactly like Miami Vice character.
Yeah.
And I started going on job interviews that way. Like I didn't even give a shit. Right. Because when I came out of school, I did so well in the program that I was getting job offers. So I was literally going to interviews like with beautiful kind of South Beach shoes with no socks, linen pants, you know, seersucker jackets, and going, what do you got type of thing, right? Not super cocky, but I just didn't even know how, I didn't even know how to dress for an interview, quite frankly. So I had three companies that made me a job offer before I graduated. And one of them was this marketing company that didn't exactly make me a job offer. They offered me an interview, but I met a guy at a party who was their banker, young guy. And he goes, what do you do when you graduate? I go, I don't know. I got two job offers right now. One was from a hospital, one was something else. And I go, yeah, a hospital might not be bad to start because they try to turn out a live human. It's a good product, right? And he goes, you really need to meet these people at this marketing agency. And I go, what do they do? He goes, I don't know. I go, you're their banker. He goes, they use computers to do marketing. I don't know what that means, but they've been growing really rapidly. So he set up the interview. I didn't. I interviewed with a bunch of people there. And at the end of the day, I was jazzed. But if you'd asked me, what do? I wouldn't be able to tell you because I did not understand what was the very beginnings of database and direct marketing is what they were doing, right? But I remember going home and thinking about it. They'd offered me $13,000 to come in at entry level, right? Which is, I got to believe that was equal to the pay of the mailroom clerk. It was so bad. Yeah. The hospital offered me $36,000 to come in at mid-level manager. They saw me as a bright 28-year-old, not a 22-year-old. They saw the experience I had. Right. And they were like, okay, it hasn't been professional, but man, guy's a worker. He gets it. Yeah. I took the $13,000 job. My instinct was screaming at me. I was like, before I signed on the line for the hospital, they wanted me to come in and do a day with the managers. And I didn't know what people did in a hospital. So I went in and it was the most boring day I had had in a long time. It was like, yeah, we push paper here and then we push paper over there.
What was the job for?
It was like a mid-level HR benefits administrator, something, right? And I was like, okay, I'm not going to be going to meetings and pushing paper. There's got to be something better than that. So they thought I was in. They'd already made me the offer. I'd gone down there. I was like, yeah, I'm just going to sign the final offer letter. It's all good to go. In the meantime, I go to this other company and I'm super jazzed. Don't know what they do. Energy levels off the chart. And my instinct is screaming at me, like, take that one. And it's like, okay, what's my downside if I take that one? Well, one, you're going to make $20,000 less. That's a fact.
Yeah.
You are going to learn marketing and you are going to learn computers, both of which you don't know anything about. But your instinct is telling you they're part of the future, that everybody's going to be needing this type of marketing or technology in the future. So that was my bet.
You just trusted it.
I trusted my bet. Huh. And I had friends that were like, you're so stupid.
Yeah.
Like, you're giving up 20 grand. I go, no.
And you're 27 or 28?
Yeah, 27 and a half when I came out. I got my bachelor's degree in 2.5 years.
That's crazy to even, obviously I've known you for the last handful of years.
I felt like I was behind, Stu.
Yeah.
When I went back to school, I was like, okay, you are like 3 to 4 years behind. You're going to be 5 years behind everybody else when you graduate. And then there was no restriction. This was kind of cool. There was no restriction at that time on how many credits you could take in a semester. Mm-hmm. So I was doing like 26.
Just random stuff.
No, in my program, I was like, okay, I'm going to do 26 credits. I mean, I'd sign up for like 9 classes, 8 classes. I didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
I mean, all I did was go to school, though, by the way, because by the time I'd gone back to school, I own 3 houses now. Remember, I'm a hard worker,
yeah.
So I'm buying houses. So I got people living in my houses. I got cash flow. I don't have to work for 2.5 years while I go to school, and I'm still making like 20 grand a year.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I think one thing that's interesting, even like in today's world, is people like with Instagram and stuff like that, where people are putting on their pages that like, oh, I have my life together. I'm doing so well. I'm 17 years old or whatever. It makes so many people think that even if they're, for example, if they were 28 getting out of school and not knowing what they want to do, that it's like, oh, you're a loser. You're never going to make anything yourself. And it's so crazy to look at your life and all you've done from many things that we'll get into more as well, that at 28, you still had no idea what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
I think that's extremely interesting.
And yeah. Stu, I meet MBA students here that come back and have gone to some amazing schools in the country,
right,
and they end up hating what they're doing. They're on Wall Street. They're in Boston. They're in New York. They're in Atlanta. They're in Chicago. I meet them. They're here. We have more than 600 MBA students. And I always, when they come see me or I run into them, I go, hey, what are you doing? Well, I spent, 3 years on Wall Street. I spent 3 years in this firm. I spent 3 years doing that. Da, 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 da. I said, but why are you here? Well, I want to get an MBA, but I know I don't want to go back to that. So I'm here in San Diego because I have a lifestyle change. I'm not just coming to get my MBA here. I'm going to stay here. And I go, what are you going to do when you get your MBA? I don't know. And I look at him and say the same thing I say to freshmen. You know what? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Here's what you should do while you're here in the MBA. Let me connect you to some people. You need an internship. Blah, 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 blah. You want to volunteer at this event. Da, da, da. Let me get you connected in San Diego.
Right.
And then if you're good, you'll find your opportunity. Yeah. So even they don't know.
Yeah.
And they've come from some schools that you would think if you go to those schools, you made it. No, there's no such thing. There's no such thing.
That's cool. I think it's definitely like enlightening to hear, especially from someone like you that's had the success you have, that it's like, you figure it out.
You do.
Yeah.
You have to trust that you're going to have an amazing life, but you don't have to know how it unfolds exactly.
And how do you program that? Like, how do you get that kind of a programming system in your head?
You meet an aunt that's dying and says, don't have any regrets.
Sure. Go to a retirement home.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean,
dying.
Part of it is, going and talking to people you want to be. If I was a freshman and I thought I wanted to be an executive at Netflix, I would figure out some way, somehow, even if I turned it into a school assignment of trying to meet the closest thing I could to an executive at Netflix. And I would say, what do you do? And are you happy doing it?
Yeah.
And meet enough of those people and they'll tell you what, how they got to where they got, which is important. And secondly, if they're happy doing it and why, because we think we know when we're young, like, isn't there a script, Stu? Isn't there a script? Go to the most amazing pre-K, get into the most amazing elementary school, set yourself up for the most amazing high school, take all your AP classes, transfer to the school of your choice. And life ever, then you know, happiness ever after, right? And so the problem is we're scripted. We're scripted from when we're 4 years old to we're 18, and now we're unscripted. So we follow what we think is another script that people tell us, like, yeah, just go to college. And then what? Well, don't worry about it, just go to college, right? And so some people aren't comfortable with that because they've been scripted the whole way. And so, you know, we're doing such a disservice to our children today to not let them be a little more independent, because by the time they get to college, they have no independence and they got to figure it out quick.
I'm curious, what are your thoughts? Because you dropped out after a year and had an incredible impact in your life. I dropped out after a year and a half and then later came back and it had the biggest impact of my entire life. And one thing that I'm really curious about is, like, what is your opinion on taking time off of school? Because you're a professor now at San Diego State. And so obviously, I think you'd have an interesting opinion.
You know, I think timing's everything. I mean, you and I think both know David. I think you know who I'm talking about, David Kay.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was struggling here. He's about 2.5 years through his program and he's kind of struggling. Right. He had made money one summer doing something and he just comes into my office and he goes, Byrne, he goes, I need to talk to you. And I go, what's up? He goes, I hate school. I go, yeah. Okay. What else you got? And he's like, no, I really hate school. And he goes, I have this opportunity to do this other thing, but Byrne, do you think it will hurt my life if I stop going to school? I go, no. You're going to go work for an entrepreneur. You're going to sell. You're going to learn. I go, that's priceless. Mm-hmm. I go, if you're meant to come back, you'll come back. And then what? 2 years later, he came back, right? And finished out his degree. He was happy. He was confident. He had gone and worked for money and he saw that wasn't a complete road to happiness either. Right now he was like, okay, I like money, but I really want to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I wish my son would have done a gap year, maybe two gap years. Yeah. My daughters were ready. He wasn't, he got hit in the head in school, like with a 2x4, he became, you know, a zombie for a couple of years, walking around trying to figure it all out. And I, as somebody that helps all these other kids, I was powerless to help my own son because I wanted to give him his space and he did not want to hear it from me. And the more he struggled, the deeper he sank. And I watched it. It's like watching my son standing in quicksand. And every 2 months I see him going a little bit lower and I'm just like, this is insane. And I wish I would have said to him, you know, hey, don't go to college, you know, for a couple of years. I wish I would have set him up with one of my friends somewhere else working for a couple of years, because he didn't know what he wanted to do. And all of his friends who had their shit together were all like, you don't have your shit together. What's wrong with you? Like, we all have our shit together. And I was like, they're lying to you. They don't have shit together. And he believed them. You know, you believe your trusted friends when you're young. I did it. I believe my friends over my parents. And he pulled out of a nosedive, but he could have hit the ground.
Right.
Yeah.
So you think if an opportunity presents itself and you could flourish and grow through that opportunity, it's okay to put school on the back burner for a little bit?
I mean, I know this is not the right example to use, but so many kids use it because they just think he was gifted and he's not. You know, Zuckerberg with Facebook.
Yeah.
You think he's a genius? He's not a genius. He was trying to build a little website to connect alumni to students in school. And somebody saw it and said, hey, if you structured it a little differently, it'd probably kick the shit out of MySpace. He was like, really? You know, and they tested it. They opened up the platform to non-alumni and it started to take off. What did he do? A year and a half at Harvard?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Did he go back?
I don't think so.
No. So I don't know. I think there's a path for everyone in life. I don't think there's one thing or another.
Yeah. But leaving school, and if you committing, like working hard, you don't want to just leave.
You don't leave. You don't leave school and idle. You leave and do something.
Yeah. Cool. So to fast forward a little bit now and get into a little bit more of your life, you were working at this marketing agency and you guys were doing $1.2 billion, I believe, right? You joined when there was 16 partners or so.
There were about 16 employees.
And you did a little bit over $1 million, right?
Yeah, about $1.7 million.
And then you took that to be...
We pivoted. I convinced them to pivot it.
Yeah.
And go in another direction.
Right. And now you're...
exploded.
And now you're 10,000 employees, 30 offices in 30 plus countries.
Yep.
$1.2 billion in revenue.
Yep.
You're living the dream, right?
Not at that point. Not at
what
that
do you
point.
Mean?
We built a great little company. I will never work with people like that again in my life. I worked with four people like they were my brothers. I didn't realize it until I left how much fun I had and how much we were warriors who trusted one another with their lives. We told things to each other that we didn't even tell our wives. That's how much we became the four musketeers, right? We did not expect the company to blow up. We wanted to create a great little company where we would like each other, treat employees fairly. We had a no asshole rule, no assholes for employees, no assholes for clients. And we would have a great, almost like a great little law firm. You know, we'd pull down $150 to $200. We're living in Silicon Valley. Like life is good, right? Yeah. Maybe it's $50 million a year in revenue max. And we control our destiny. We don't want to build the biggest ship in the world. We just want to own our ship. Well, it started to go. And when something goes, it goes. And so what I thought was going to be this little company that we build in less than 2 years grew to 40 million. And in, you know, another year, 300 million. I mean, it was like insanity how quickly it grew. And we lost control of it at the end. I mean, right at the end, it was almost like Gordon Gekko on Wall Street, where greed is good. We had so many different investors we didn't know and so many people on our board that I didn't know that we'd lost the company, literally lost the company. And I remember walking through an LA office at the time and looking at some work on a wall for a client and just thinking it was shit. And I was like, wow, we have lowered our bar. Like we suck. And within a month I resigned. I went to the other partners and said, I have to leave. And they were like, where are you going? And I was like, I go, we suck, guys. And they were like, no, we're just growing. We're doing this. I go, I'm out.
What made you be willing to do that? Cause I'm sure financially you're doing great, right? Marketing is something you're really good at.
Well,
cause what most people would you say they'll be like, maybe the work's not as good.
Well,
but hey.
Two things happen that make you think differently about that. If you're ever fortunate enough to have someone from Goldman Sachs hand you a seven-figure check and you're just a little immigrant kid, and you realize you don't have to work again in your life, right? And it did two things to me. One, it made me smile.
Yeah.
Okay. The second, it threw me into a tailspin because my goal, when people used to say, what's your goal with this company? And what's your goal in life? I would be like, I was a little bit before Braveheart, you know, but Braveheart came out and he said it perfectly well, freedom, right? So I used to tell people, I don't want to be rich. I just want financial freedom. And they go, what is financial freedom? I go, the ability to make enough money or have enough invested that you can do what you want, right? Because I didn't live large. I didn't live large. I didn't spend money. And so when someone gives you that amount of money, then, you know, someone asked me within like 2 or 3 months of getting that check, what's your goal now?
You achieved it.
Yeah. Well, there's a problem when you don't have another goal. I was goalless. And so then I became rudderless. And for 2 years while we're still exploding and I'm launching Amazon, I'm doing Yahoo, I'm doing Travelocity, I'm launching Widmer Beer, I'm doing work with just a bunch of people, right? Big brands. And I was like, you know, mimic man. I was just going through the motions, mimicking what I used to do and being on the head of this rocket ship, but I wasn't there. But I was still doing great work. Yeah. I had hired great people. That's something I learned, hire great people. So I was rudderless. I remember telling my wife, I go, I don't know why I go in every day anymore. She goes, what are you talking about? And I go, the company, we're losing control of it. I'm going around to other offices. The work is shit. I had clients call me and complain. I go, I've never had a client call me and complain in 5 years based on our work. And so I was like, I got to find something to do either within this company or somewhere else. Right. She goes, would you leave? And I go, I don't give a shit. The company that I helped build is no longer there. It's gone. Right. Some big corporate animal is there now. And I don't even recognize it. So about stumbling through that year and a half, 2 years. And I just, you know, told her one day, I said, today's my last day.
So I'm just no more.
Yeah. Walking in and saying I'm out.
Okay. And so after that, then you decided to come to San Diego, correct?
Yep.
Help turn around companies.
Yep.
What made that your next like move? Why was it that?
You know, I'll use a military analogy. Let's say, or maybe I should use, what's the movie with Russell Crowe? Gladiator. Okay. So let's assume I'm a tiny little gladiator.
Okay.
Not a big gladiator, but looking at the movie with Russell Crowe, even when he was put into slavery and then being trained, he was being trained to fight where?
War.
No. Where was he being trained to fight when he was a gladiator? What was the big city you would go to?
Rome.
Rome. And what was the big arena?
Colosseum.
Colosseum. So here's the metaphor. Bernie just wants to build a little marketing company, but he's a gladiator, a marketing gladiator. And it turns out they end up in Rome and they are in the Colosseum with the, one of the largest agencies in the world, written about in the Wall Street Journal, all business magazine covers. And you get there and you fight in the Colosseum and you win. What do you do now? You just fight? You just fight to fight? No, my mission and my cause is done. So if you're a gladiator, what do? You find another arena. So I picked San Diego as my arena. I said, you know what? Go to a place where no one knows you. Let's see how good you are by yourself. So that's why I came to San Diego. I came here not knowing anyone in the city. One phone call from a CEO of a company and he needed help. And I worked it out. I came here. I didn't know any other employees, a 400 person company. I don't know any other employees. I only know the CEO. I don't know San Diego. I've never been here. And I was like, I'm being dropped behind enemy lines. I'm going in.
Yeah.
And honestly, for myself, it was like, let's see how good you are by yourself, yeah. Vern. And let's see how good you are as a marketing guy. No distractions, no multiple clients, no employees.
All you.
Yeah, all me. And I
worked out pretty well.
It's not how it worked out pretty well. For me, mentally, my senses were 100% alive. I was on fire. I couldn't wait to go into work. Yeah. I couldn't wait to solve problems. I woke up every day without alarm clocks. I mean, I was so, I hadn't been jazzed like that for about 6 or 7 years. And I was so jazzed. I was just jazzed. And it was like, man, I got to turn this company around. Man, this company's going to fail if I don't fix it. Yeah. I mean, I was on fire. And when I fixed it and they sold it, it was like, damn, that thing, I just brought in $2 billion in revenue and sold this company for $400 million. Like freaking A. Yeah. This was awesome. Yeah. And I was like, you know, Kill Bill again. So I went and found three more guys over the next 6 years and fixed broken companies until I woke up one day and I was like, fixing broken companies sucks because it's only about the money and the challenge. It's, you don't even get to know the people. I mean, you're like, you're like a mercenary on fire. And after doing that for a total of 8 years, I realized, okay, you can't keep doing this.
Yeah,
there is no, there's satisfaction, but no soul satisfaction. You're just winning.
Yeah.
And what's the cause we're fighting for? Winning. Huh. But what's the cause? I don't have one.
Yeah.
So I woke up, resigned from the last one. And within 1 month interviewed with all the deans in San Diego, because I made the decision that the best feeling I'd had in my life was whenever I would do a guest talk on a college campus. So I was like, I'm going to get on a college campus. So I just interviewed all the deans.
Yeah. Huh. What like kind of advice would you have for someone? Like you helped all these companies rebrand themselves, but as far as when it comes to like an individual rebranding themselves, like what kind of advice would you have for that? If, let's say someone was like at a job and they feel really stuck or they're
it's funny because, you know, I love this whole idea of individual branding that seems to have come up in the millennial age. I think it's all bullshit, by the way. You evolve.
Brands and bullshit.
You evolve. You don't brand yourself. you evolve against your skills and your expertise. Because to me, when someone brands themselves, they're painting a veneer, and I don't know the depth of that veneer. I would rather meet people that are comfortable in their expertise than show me their brand or tell me what they're doing to brand themselves on social media. And to me, it's all bullshit. Like, if you're really good, opportunity and people will find you. If you got to tell people how good you are through your branding, then you're doing wax on, wax off. It's what I call, it's faux branding. It's actually just PR, and there's no depth to you. So I'd rather have people focus on building their expertise and their depth. And, you know, you can define yourself by where you work and who you hang out with, not how you position yourself in social media. Yeah, that's just all faux to me.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's like saying to someone, yeah, I'm a race car driver. Great, great. What kind of car do you drive? Oh, I got a stock car. You want to see my race uniform? I went to racing school. How many races have you run? None.
Yeah.
But I'm a race car driver.
Yeah.
I want to meet the kid that doesn't say a word, and that he's in the back of the room, and he's the NASCAR champion. That's the kid I want to talk to.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just goes and does it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So as you came back to teach at San Diego State.
Yep.
I believe it was a week, maybe a month after you'd been here. One of the deans came up to you and said, all right, Bernie, we just got a multi-million-dollar donation. We're going to create this on, we're like, we have an entrepreneur program. And you ask him like, all right, what's the entrepreneur program? And he turns to you and says, well, we need you to create it.
So
yeah. Can you walk us through that and why you were willing to take
so
off?
So I did not have a graduate degree when I met with all the deans of all the schools in San Diego. I had a good vibe for San Diego State. I walked the campus. I talked to students. You know, I did my due diligence on which campus I wanted to be on. I had the best vibe here. When I met with the dean and said, hey, you know, I'd like to teach marketing part-time. And they knew my background.
Yeah.
Belch, the chair of the marketing department, was like, shit, these guys created a great marketing. Like, this guy is one of like the key guys. And so he knew, but he didn't say anything in the meeting. It was kind of cool. And so they go, do you have a graduate degree? I go, no. And they go, I go, will you waive that? They go, no. I go, well, how do you get in the MBA program here? Well, you got to take the GMAT. Will you waive that? No. I mean, everything was no. And the next day, but I still, no to me is just, it defines another opportunity if you want to look at it that way. The next day, I enrolled in the MBA program through Open University, in which you can take three courses before you're admitted. I signed up for a course in how to take the GMAT, and I spent 6 weeks on Saturdays learning how to take this freaking test. And then I got into the MBA program. Before I was out of the MBA program, I was already teaching marketing classes. Belch already had me teaching internet marketing while I was finishing my MBA. And started teaching more marketing classes that following spring. And then I ran into the executive director of the Entrepreneur Center. It wasn't the dean that asked me. And he said that he wanted to build up the entrepreneur programs here. I said, dude, I've been on this campus almost 2 years. I haven't heard shit about an Entrepreneur Center. And he goes, that's part of the problem, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, what do you do? He explained two programs that they were running. I said, honestly, that's terminally disinteresting to me if that's what you do. And he said, well, what would interest you? And I go, give me five things. Or give me three things that'll take me 5 years to do. He goes, give me 48 hours. 48 hours later, we met, and he's like, okay, you need to raise $10 million. You need to create a miner to go across the campus, and we need to get an incubator. And I go, well, how much money do you have now? He goes, oh, I forgot to tell you, we're running out of money. We only have 12 months of money left, or the center shuts down. I was like, sign me up.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of, like, you were excited to come back, teach, to give basically to others.
100%. It wasn't for the money. Trust me.
It was the perfect platform.
Yeah. I did not realize how college campuses functioned, what the opportunities were. Certainly didn't understand there were entrepreneur centers. It's been, what's crazy is this year was my 10th year on the campus.
Congrats.
It's the longest I've been anywhere.
Really?
Yeah.
And you enjoy it?
Still, otherwise I wouldn't be here. The day I stop enjoying it, you won't see me here.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah.
No regrets.
Yeah, never.
Yeah. Okay. And so as you're now teaching, you're creating this program, you're teaching marketing, entrepreneurship, one day you get an idea that, hey, I'm gonna write a book. Not as if you hadn't done enough already.
No, it's not how it happened. Exactly. How did it happen? I was asked to do a private talk at the University Club downtown on the state of education on a college campus. So this was a private talk with senior executives down at the, you know, kind of hoi polloi 29th floor of the University Club. So these are all like C-level people in the room, and they probably were looking to hear a pithy, you know, update on education. And my, my presentation was, we are failing our students. And they, and I started going into everything we were doing wrong on a college campus. Right. And they thought it was going to be the super upbeat conversation. And I totally Debbie Downered the room. Like, I was like, we are sucking at this. We are sucking at that. We don't do this correctly. We don't do that correctly. We're not teaching kids how to fail fast. We're teaching them in a rote way. We're teaching them to follow scripts. And at the end of that presentation, this guy came up to me and he goes, hey, I'm putting on TED Talks. The talk you just gave is a TED Talk. And I go, no, it's not. And he goes, yes, it is. So I did a TED Talk. And it was the day after the TED Talk, I got a phone call at the university, and it was a publisher from New York. And he goes, my name is so-and-so, and I heard you did a talk yesterday. I go, and TED Talks are private until they're published, right? It takes about 4 months to get a video up online on a TED Talk. So I go, how do you know that? And he goes, I had a friend who was there, and he said that you have a book, is a book. The talk you gave on failing fast is a book. And I was like, I'm thinking to myself, this is bullshit. Like, who is this guy calling from New York? So he says, just send me your PowerPoint. So I'm like, okay, I don't care. Right. Send him the PowerPoint. He calls me back on the phone and he goes, can you do a table of contents tonight? I go, on what? He goes, on a book. He goes, just the titles of the chapters, 15. Just do the titles. What would you put in it? So I'm like, well, I can do that, right? Yeah. So I go home. I'm working like 10 o'clock at night. I'm writing my, and not thinking I'm going to write a book. Like, this is all a goof, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So send him that the next morning. He comes right back at me within an hour. And he goes, you know, could you do like a short paragraph on what would be in each chapter? And so I'm like, oh, shit. You know, in for a penny, in for a pound. Yeah, he's totally smooth. It's totally working. And once I did the little paragraphs, the next email from him is, we would like to offer you a contract to write this book. We think this could be an amazing book. So that's how the book came about.
Dang.
Yeah, crazy.
That's crazy.
I never thought in my life I would be an author ever.
Yeah, that's crazy. So you're, I mean, so many different things you've done in your life, and you've done so incredibly at them. And so how would you say that you've been able to be so like multifaceted? And I mean, obviously we live a long time, and if you focus, you can accomplish a lot of things, but how have you been able to come so good?
So here's
things?
Somebody asked me at a public talk one day, how did you build your career? And I go, with 10,000 small decisions. Everybody thinks that you hit a home run in your life to carve out your opportunities. You don't. The decisions are really, really small. So you might say, well, what was the decision that led to the book? I agreed to speak to a private group at the University Club when I had no reason to.
Yeah.
It was going to be on a Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. I don't want to come downtown on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, but this guy called me. He's like, we have a gap in our schedule. Would you talk about it? I didn't have a presentation done. I was like, yeah, cause I came referred to him from somebody else. Right. So now I'm like, shit, you know, I got to let that guy down. So I was like, yeah, I'll do the talk.
Interesting.
Your life is full of little tiny forks and rivers, left, right, go, don't go, meet that person, don't meet that person, turn that thing in, go to that class, go to that, thousands. Those are the things that shape your opportunities. It doesn't look like it when you do it. You can't purposely pick them all and go, that's going to lead to an amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
You just agree to do the next thing. Like, I agreed to a phone conversation to talk to a CEO in San Diego. I could have said, F San Diego. I don't want to go there. And who's this financial services gweeb, and why should I talk to him?
Yeah.
Instead, I was like, I'll take the conversation. Want to come down and talk to me face to face?
Yeah,
I'll do that.
Interesting.
You got to understand when options make themselves available to you that aren't opportunities yet, but they're little tiny doors that are options. And they don't, you don't always see what's behind them completely. You just have to decide, yeah, I want to, I'll do that. I'll meet that person. Right. I'll go to that event. You know, like I tell people all the time, especially freshmen, you haven't met the person that'll change your life yet. And they look at me like, how the hell am I going to find them? I go, get you off your ass and get out there. You know, you weren't born to marry a specific person. So the random way that you meet them, okay, there's someone else somewhere else that would have been just as good. And they look at me like, no, yeah. I love this person. They're the only one for me. And I'm like, it was so random how you met them. Okay.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So a couple of just a little bit more random questions that I want to ask you.
Okay.
Before we wrap this thing up, what's your favorite word in the English language?
Well, you know what it
and
is.
Why?
It's awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah, you hear me all around the campus. People ask me every single day, how are you? And I go, awesome. I think I could be on fire. And people go, look, dude's on fire. How you doing? I'm awesome.
Why is your favorite word awesome?
Because in the first marketing agency, we exploded in growth. My mentor rose. I rose. In 2 years, I went from just above mailroom clerk status as an account coordinator, and I was a vice president in 2 years, right?
That's crazy.
I remember working late one night, like I always did, and the CEO came by, right? Who I didn't see a lot. Right. Remember, my mentor was the president, and he's walking in the hallway. It's like 8 o'clock at night, and I'm working on my computer, right? Yeah. Lights on. He's probably thinking, what's he doing here? So he stops in my office, pokes his head in the door, and he goes, how's it going? And I was beat up. It was toward the end of the week. And I go, it's okay. And he comes in, he stops. And then now he's in my office. I'm like, oh shit. So he sits down in my guest chair and he goes, let me explain something to you about life. You're either where you are for a reason and you have a purpose for being there, or you're not. You either love what you're doing or you don't.
Right.
Now, I have some news to share with you. I fired the entire management team tonight. They've been mismanaging the company, and our company is headed for bankruptcy unless we fix it. And I need your help to fix it. I go, you fired Gus, who was like the president and my mentor. He's like, yeah. So there's like dead silence. And he looks at me. He goes, can I count on you to help me build the company and save it? And I looked at him and I said, absolutely. And then he looks at me and he goes, how you doing? I go, John, I'm doing freaking awesome.
That's cool.
And I have been saying that for the last 35 years.
Dang. That's pretty
Because
awesome.
He taught me a valuable lesson.
Yeah.
You're either where you are or you're not. You decide.
Okay.
So I decided I was going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So now you know where it came from.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
And on the other side of the spectrum, what's your least favorite word in the English language?
No.
And I feel like I know what that is, but could you explain why that is?
You know, I think a lot of people jump to no because it's safe. I don't like no. I've never liked no. When somebody tells me no, it just fires me up. Like if somebody would have said... If I would have said a year ago, I'm going to get Ralph Rubio to talk on the campus, there's no way that's going to happen. You don't know the dude. He's held in high regard by development. We don't want you talking to him. I'd be like, okay, I'm going to get freaking Ralph Rubio. I don't care what it takes now. So when somebody says no to me, it's like the red flag in front of a bull.
Yeah.
Game on.
Yeah.
Game on.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And so what's the best piece of advice you would say that you've received in your life, and who gave you that piece of advice?
You know, again, I don't think there's magic or silver bullets in people's lives. I think there's a accumulation of things. But I would go back to my aunt in the no regret. And I didn't even know what it meant at the time. I just walked out of there going, I will not have regrets. I didn't know what that meant. I hadn't had a lot of regrets. I was relatively young, pretty naive. But I tell you, her random utterance to me and her conversation with me, you know, I still didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know where I was going to do it. I didn't even know how my life was going to turn out. But man, I walked out of there going, not going to have any regrets.
Yeah.
Don't know what I'm doing, but I'm not going to have any regrets. And I shaped all my decisions after that. Who I dated, who I talked to, whether trips I went on, jobs I took, jobs I didn't take. I would always ask myself, you know, would you ever regret not doing that? Would you regret not going to that meeting? Would you regret da 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 da? And it wasn't like sometimes I even said it out loud. It became part of me. It became part of my insight. I wouldn't even think about it anymore. And I would start to make decisions based on it. It just became part of my DNA. I really absorbed it hard.
Would you recommend and this is kind of deep, but like, would you recommend for people to go have a conversation with someone that's dying?
You know, that's a tough one because everybody deals with people differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up in a pretty, you know, straightforward, you know, Teutonic German family where emotion was not rewarded. My dad never said he loved me until he was 68. Now, I didn't take that as a negative. Right. The guy was working two jobs and putting five kids to a private school. I mean, his life was shit now that I look back, right? But then he got comfortable with it. And so I never understood why nobody said that to me. I just thought that was normal, right? Yeah. That love is shown, it's never said. So I made sure from the moment my children could understand that I'd say it to them.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
I always say it to my children, even now.
Yeah.
You know, when I see them and they leave dinner, somebody love you, man.
Yeah.
Because there's no reason not to. There was no reason to hide behind a facade. Yeah. You know, you can show your emotion. It doesn't make you less, you know, of a leader in a family type of a thing.
Right.
Yeah, it makes you a little bit more human. But that was part of the culture. It's all culture. So no regrets.
Yeah. Okay. And so before I ask my last question, I was just wondering if you could share with all the listeners where they can find more information on you. If they want to like get in contact with you or anything like that.
Well, I don't want them contacting me.
So that's
I have enough people that I'm dealing with. I have like 36,000 students on this campus.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say the best way to understand me is to go look up, you know, a couple of my talks. I think one of my creativity talks is online.
Yeah.
My TED talk is online. I think that kind of shows a little bit about where I am now. The books that I've written are not autobiographical. I wrote books for other people. Yeah. I mean, the best email I ever got was from a guy in Africa, can't even remember the village, who said that he bought Fail Fast and created a small business out of solar panels and light bulbs to light huts in his village. And he was renting them out. And he goes, thank you so much for this book. And I was like, that is the exact person I wrote my book for. The person I would never, people used to say, who'd you write a book for? Like your kids, your wife, your I go, no, I wrote it for the person I'd never meet. It's that guy.
That's cool.
Yeah. So I think they don't need to buy my books. You want to check them out, but only to learn.
Right.
I think if you see those two talks on creativity and on failing, you'll start to understand what makes me tick.
Yeah. So last question on this show, we go out to find the most passionate, fulfilled people in life. And obviously learn how they found their direction in life. And I think we've gained a lot from our conversation. And I think one of the most important things, though, is we want to leave people with actionable steps, things they can apply to their life. And so my last question for you is, what is something that someone listening or watching this can do in the next 24 or 48 hours to start finding their direction in their own life?
Yeah, I would say fire up your curiosity. You know, go investigate the things that you're curious about. I have about 35 Google alerts that come to me on different keywords, you know, on just different subject matter. Go into a store you've never been into, eat a product you've never experienced before, go to an event you would never go to. Start to make curiosity a normal part of your life. That will lead to meeting more people. And if you're paying attention and listening, then you will meet some amazing people. And then you can decide which people you want to engage harder with in those moments. And those people could become influential in your life.
Awesome.
Yep.
Cool.
Get your own word.
I will.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having
me. And yeah, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right.
Take care.
Congratulations, my friend, on crushing it through another episode here on Finding Direction. I hope you give yourself a pat on the back, a round of applause, because you are one of the few who is not willing to settle for less than a life that lights up your soul, and that is absolutely something worth celebrating. I hope you got something from that conversation with Bernie, and as always, I hope you take at least one thing from that episode and start applying it to your life today. Other than that, my friend, have a wonderful, beautiful, outstanding rest of your day. I will talk to you on the podcast soon. Take care.